Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, July 3rd, 2015. A top diplomat with the African Union visits South Sudan to hear President Kiir's plan for peace in the country.
My first duty will be to listen to the South Sudanese authorities. If we don't listen to them, if we don't listen to President Salva Kiir, and if we don't listen to other leaders of South Sudan, we will not be able to make any other contribution, and that contribution as a brother.
And South Sudanese religious leaders are calling on both sides of the warring parties to stop promoting hate speech.
And they don't see the incitement of communities, the incitement of a tribe, it will generate a very serious crime. So I am asking our politicians in the parliament or wherever they speak, they have to mind themselves of what they are saying.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The African Union Special Envoy to South Sudan, former Malian President Alpha Omar Conaré, arrived in Juba today to meet with President Salva Kiir and other top government officials. Conaré says his visit is aimed at kick-starting the stalled peace process mediated by the regional bloc IGAD. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
This marks Alpha Omar Conaré's first visit to South Sudan since AU chairperson Kozazana Dlamini Zuma named him the organization's special envoy to South Sudan, replacing former South African President Thabo Mbeki. Speaking in French upon his arrival this morning, Conaré's message was simple.
We all wish that there be peace that the people of South Sudan have been looking for and that there be harmony, that these be prevailing in the country. This peace, which is a very precious commodity, is not beyond the reach of South Sudanese people. It's the South Sudanese themselves who are going to make peace. But we are going to help them to do that. We are here to support them and to be with them.
During his two-day visit, Conaré will meet with President Kiir along with the representatives from civil society groups in hopes of jump-starting the stalled peace process. His trip is also intended to explore how the AU can play a more significant role in efforts to end the fighting.
My first duty will be to listen to the South Sudanese authorities. If we don't listen to them, if we don't listen to President Salva Kiir, and if we don't listen to other leaders of South Sudan, we will not be able to make any other contribution, and that contribution as a brother, and which in other circumstances will be helping greatly our brothers.
The AU conducted an investigation into crimes and other atrocities committed during the 18-month-long conflict, but has yet to publicly release the results of that investigation. Other international organizations, including the United Nations, have said both the government and rebel forces are guilty of committing atrocities. Some analysts say releasing the AU report could derail efforts to sign a comprehensive peace agreement to end the crisis. Peter Basir Bendi, the South Sudanese Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, says the Kiir administration will brief Conaré about
the genesis of the crisis and how it started and how far we have gone with the process of the peace. Definitely, we will give him all the details that we have and the concessions that the government has given and the commitment of the government to achieve peace for the people of South Sudan.
Both government and rebel leaders have repeatedly stated their commitment to ending the conflict while fighting continues in parts of the country and no tangible results have come from on-again, off-again peace talks. The latest round of talks collapsed on March 6 following the failure of President Kiir and Riek Machar to sign a comprehensive peace agreement by a regionally imposed deadline. Another summit was held in June in South Africa but yielded little progress. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
The authorities in Western Bahr al-Ghazal state have set up an emergency court to deal with a rising wave of robberies and looting in the state. Officials say that since the court was established, 21 suspected criminals have been arrested and their cases will be quickly decided as the police crackdown intensifies. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Wau.
21 suspects, including army and police personnel, were arrested last Saturday, just 2 days after former acting state police commissioner Deng Malwal was replaced by Chol Tuch. The suspects were arrested as they roamed around at night, carrying weapons but wearing civilian clothing. Western Baal Ghazali State Governor Rizik Zakaria Hassan says many of the suspected criminals are from neighboring states.
These criminals are not from Wau. These ones came from outside. Our gangs here drink and cause problem or enter the shop to steal. But this one of these days are very unique and need technical approach.
The governor says the new emergency court will begin trying suspects next week. The court was developed in consultation with the state judiciary, which has provided a judge to oversee adjudications. The court is expected to ease the load in the Western Baal Ghazal State Judicial Court, where many cases wait months to be heard. Hassan says the new court will allow suspects to be jailed only briefly and tried quickly. He says the new system should allow the state authorities to avoid repeats of past incidents where suspects escaped from jail before they were sentenced for their crimes because of lengthy delays in bringing them before a judge. Hassan says the police force has shown itself incapable of protecting civilian lives and property. The governor says his night patrol forces are letting him down.
The police in patrol before have failed because the robbers have extended their operation. We also learned that those in charge of patrol go and sleep at night, and the rest of the patrol go and loot and rob. This is what we have here. Civilians could call on patrol, but they could not rescue them as they arrive late at the scene.
Chol Tuch is the new police commissioner in Western Baal Ghazal. He says the 21 suspects who have been arrested will be tried in the emergency court. He suspects that some police and army soldiers are allowing their guns be used by the robbers in exchange for money. He says they could be allowing gangs to use their weapons in exchange for a cut of their property or money they steal. But he assures the public that he will protect them and their property. Despite the creation of the new court and promises of security crackdowns, several homes and shops were looted as recently as Tuesday night. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Wau.
An international human rights activist says once peace is restored in South Sudan, the country needs to quickly set up a court system to look into alleged crimes committed during the conflict. Arnold Songa, the director of the International Commission of Jurists, say South Sudan should look to Rwanda and Sierra Leone as examples of how transitional courts can successfully administer justice in a country emerging from conflict.
A good transitional justice framework should also have an outcome where there can be possible imposition of sanctions for some of those who are responsible, especially for the serious human rights violations that would have taken place during the conflict. And then you would also want a situation where the objective of this process of transitional justice results in the prevention of future abuses. Given these very ideal objectives or goals of a transitional justice framework for any country that is going through conflict like South Sudan, the question which you then ask is there one in Africa that answered to these requirements?
I want us to look at an example of one in Africa that met those requirements or, you know, answered those requirements.
One example that people always talk about is that of South Africa, because of the fact that coming from a situation of intense conflict as a result of the apartheid system, it became possible for the country to move from a situation of extreme polarization into a situation where there was a stoppage of extrajudicial killings. Another example that may be useful, Rwanda. Rwanda may actually be quite close to South Sudan in terms of the ethnic dimension of the generalized conflict, and in particular the extrajudicial killings, the genocide that took place in Rwanda.
Analysts in the region are saying that the courts in South Sudan are weak or rather compromised, and hence there's a need for formation of a hybrid court, possibly in the neighboring countries, to ensure that there is impartiality, credibility, and equal fairness.
It's true. And I think, in all fairness to the judiciary in South Sudan, it was never given a chance. You know, the country was new. It didn't have any institutions or systems. So at the stage of gaining independence and being given a country without any instruments and systems and institutions that were functional, then the countries, you know, slipped back into conflict before the institutions were strong enough to provide checks and balances and accountability, as well as a framework of legal protection for human rights. So the judiciary is essentially absent outside of Juba. But even within Juba itself, it is incapable of addressing especially the violators who work with the acquiescence or the authority of the state authorities. So to that extent, it is true that the justice system and pursuit of violators cannot be left to the local courts alone. So the strong argument for a hybrid mechanism where you get local South Sudanese judicial officers working together with international experts in a hybrid environment for purposes of dealing with the impunity. That is the reason why South Sudan finds itself in cycles of conflict, intergenerational conflict. That is one of the recommendations. The problem with that is that there isn't too much experience in Africa where you have had a hybrid type of courts. What we have had, like in Rwanda and Sierra Leone, it's more ad hoc tribunals that are established with a specific target. But with South Sudan, I would tend to agree with international opinion.
That's Arnold Songa, director of the Africa Regional Program of Global Human Rights Group, the International Commission of Juries. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, humanitarians say the economic outlook for the Horn of Africa is not good. Find out why when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you know any first aid techniques to help someone who may be sick or injured?
Talk of a person who is injured, maybe they have a cut. We can always dress the wound. When we talk about dressing the wound, that involves cleaning it up, bandaging it and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, maybe nose bleeds and just in someone's heart a little bit, like a scratch. We were taught in primary school,
mouth to mouth.
Mouth to mouth? That's in case somebody is drowning. You get a person out of water and you try to get some water, like water that the person had taken in, and you do a mouth-to-mouth to get the rest of it out. Survival instincts.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. A new UN report gives a miserable forecast through October for the Horn of Africa and the Great Lakes region. It warns of more intense and widespread violence, greater population displacement, and economic shocks. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports from Washington.
OCHA, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, says the Horn of Africa and the Great Lakes region are home to some of the world's most vulnerable people. That's despite economic growth and progress in achieving the Millennium Development Goals. The report states that there has been a step change in the region's threat level in 2015. Pete Manfield is head of OCHA's regional office for Eastern Africa.
If we look at what the dominating humanitarian characteristics were for Eastern Africa 9 months ago, you could summarize it as a persistent high chronic food and nutrition crises or emergency in pockets across the region, with a slow-burn refugee crisis mostly dominated from South Sudan.
Things have worsened since then.
We've seen Burundi, the political crisis in Burundi, which is increasingly having regional impacts, not just in terms of refugee outflows, but actually starting to threaten stability in the wider region. We've seen the economy in South Sudan reach crisis point, both in terms of oil revenues and its ability to pay civil servants. And of course, we've seen Yemen get substantially worse, and we're on the verge of that becoming a new global crisis.
The humanitarian scenario says the situation in Burundi will most likely remain restive for the foreseeable future. Well over 140,000 people have fled the country since early April, after President Pierre Nkurunziza declared he would seek a third term. Yemen is included with the African hotspots because thousands are fleeing fighting there and going to Djibouti and Somalia. Those countries have their own migrant, refugee, and food security problems. Those fleeing Yemen are not only citizens, but African migrants and refugees now forced to return to the continent.
Now, these three crises, coupled with the protracted situation in food and nutrition, are presenting a new threat. And we think the line has basically been passed in the sand in terms of threat level. This is having compounding impacts on states, not just those in conflict, but those that are neighboring to conflict centers.
Manfield says these crises coincide with a record level of global humanitarian needs.
Our concern is that the region will be overlooked both politically and financially. We need obviously adequate finance to respond, and we need the right level of political engagement to solve crises at their source. And that's never been more needed now in Burundi and South Sudan and Yemen in order to stop this deteriorating further.
Crises in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East have a common byproduct: thousands of migrants and refugees fleeing to Europe. Unresolved conflict and violence in Somalia and the eastern DRC are having detrimental effects on neighboring countries. These include attacks by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab in Kenya and the flood of refugees from Congo. Meeting all the humanitarian needs takes money, and there's stiff competition for it.
Overall, aggregate humanitarian funding levels globally has never been higher. The problem is that the humanitarian requirements are also at a historic high. So the requirements globally for humanitarian assistance, if you add up all of the UN appeals, is just over $20 billion. That is an unprecedented level of requirements. And what we found is that the overall level of contributions as they stand at the end of last year was about $8.5-9 billion. What we don't see is donors finding more resources to fund commensurate at the same level.
Manfield says as a result, when funding decisions are made, Syria, Nepal, and South Sudan may get the bulk of the money. Less funding would be available for new crises, like Burundi.
Burundi's having a very, very difficult time attracting funding because it's having to compete with other crises globally in the region which are sucking vast amounts of money.
He says Syria accounts for about 30% of the entire global aid requirement for 2015. The OCHA official says that humanitarian responses alone cannot solve these crises, adding political solutions can. He warns there will be massive humanitarian consequences if that does not happen. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
As part of our series leading up to the fourth anniversary of independence, we spoke with veterans of the two Sudanese civil wars that eventually led to the birth of South Sudan. The veterans say South Sudanese should celebrate the country's fourth birthday, even though parts of the country are experiencing conflict. They also have words of comfort for South Sudanese that even this crisis can be resolved. VOA fellow Kaltuma Vanessa has this report for VOA from Washington.
Paul Longa Recipico fought in the First Sudanese Civil War, which is sometimes referred to as Anyanya One, after the Southern Separatist rebel group that led that fight against Khartoum. Around 500,000 people died in that war, which began in 1955 and lasted until 1972, Recipco rose to the rank of Lieutenant General in the Anyonya movement. Today, Recipco is the security advisor for Eastern Equatorial State. He says finally achieving independence in 2011 meant a lot to him and many other in South Sudan.
Independence means coming out of the yoke of an enemy, be it economical independence or sole independence for integrity of the people of South Sudan.
Recipco says even though part of South Sudan are still midst in conflict, people should celebrate the fourth anniversary of independence.
The problems cannot stop us from celebrating the independence. We cannot wait for those problems to be solved and then we come down to celebrate. We celebrate while we find the ways of convincing whoever is aggrieved and takes the arm against the nation.
Bakulu Edward Kano in the Sudan People Liberation Army, or SPLA, during the Second Sudanese Civil War. More than 2 million people died in that conflict, which raged from 1983 until the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2005. Today, Edward is a member of the Western Equatorial State Parliament and the deputy chairman of the ruling party in the state. Edward notes that many of South Sudan's leaders also fought in the SPLA, but he says after independence in 2011, some of them became greedy for power.
Our unfortunate thing is that after getting the independence, some people begin to have the feeling that this is our property, this is ours, and it is us to control it, it is us to enjoy it more, or because we started it all, or because we formulated it all, and those competing negative elements, in fact, is the one now hindering us.
Edward says the leaders' hunger for more power pushed the South Sudan back into conflict. But, he says, if South Sudanese put aside their difference and unite, they will help to bring peace to the country.
We are going to get such a speed to move forward. We will be united despite these setbacks. It is not forever. It is not permanent. We will make it. That's what I can say.
South Sudanese plunged back into violence in December 2011, 18 months after independence. This Independence Day on July 9th will be the second that South Sudan will mark amid that conflict.
That report was by Kaltuma Vanessa and VOA fellow Justin Tito. Religious leaders say despite the ongoing conflict, South Sudanese still have a cause to celebrate the country's fourth independence anniversary. They say they are working together to urge the country's political leaders to make peace now, but they are also urging them to apologize for dragging the country back into a prolonged conflict. Charlton Doki has this report for VOA from Juba.
Archbishop Daniel Dengbul is head of the Episcopal Church of Sudan.
For me, the fourth anniversary is very important. It is reminding us of the struggle that our people have done. They have struggled, they have died, and because of their life, because of their death, we received the independence of the Republic of South Sudan. Also, we need to congratulate the people of the Republic of South Sudan for the bold decision they made. They freed themselves and become a new nation.
Retired Bishop of Torit Diocese, Bishop Emeritus Paride Taban, says he does not understand why South Sudanese must still suffer after they ended a long civil war with the government in Khartoum. Bishop Paride says South Sudan's leaders have let down not only their people, but also outsiders who helped end the war with Khartoum and supported the country's independence.
We should really apologize to each other for not being honest to one another. We should apologize to one another. We should apologize to all those who helped us to reach this independence, internationally, nationally, in Africa, within ourselves. We are talking now. People are dying in the bush.
Bishop Paride says instead of working for the good of the country, South Sudan's leaders have only caused more pain and suffering.
I'm saying to all South Sudanese, in the government, in the opposition part, we are all guilty. There's nobody who is not guilty. I've seen these days, even now in Wau, street boys eating rubbish in the garbage. We had no street children. What caused this? And sometimes in Juba or in the city, we are dancing, celebrating, and see the future of South Sudanese anguishing in the bush.
And Archbishop Bull says it's very important for politicians to stop inciting their supporters to carry out attacks or revenge attacks against rival communities.
And they don't see the incitement of communities, the incitement of a tribe. It will generate a very serious crime. So I am asking our politician in the parliament or wherever they speak, they have to mind themselves of what they are saying. What they are saying is actually agitating that group you are representing. And that can put this country into a danger.
Bishop Paride says as the country celebrates the fourth independence anniversary, South Sudan's leaders should end the conflict and apologize to the millions of people affected by nearly 15 months of fighting.
Are we seeing these bones lying in the forest being finished by guns? And who is accountable for those children, for those men who have left widows and orphans behind? Who is going to apologize to the women and to the orphans of these people?
Bishop Paride says when South Sudan gained independence, most people expected to live in a democratic country where communities coexist peacefully. He says he is disappointed that only 4 years into South Sudan's independence, the country's leaders are importing weapons to kill fellow South Sudanese. Archbishop Bull says religious leaders are working together to reconcile communities torn apart by war.
And they don't see the incitement of communities, the incitement of a tribe. It will generate a very serious crime. So I am asking our politician in the parliament or wherever they speak, they have to mind themselves of what they are saying. What they are saying is actually agitating that group you are representing. And that can put this country into a danger.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song For de l'amour by Congolese music star Jebe Piana.
L'amour, est-ce aimer ou être aimé? Bien que l'amour soit le symbole d'un sentiment partagé, être aimé n'est jamais le signe d'un bonheur parfait. Lula Masia, yende kisinanga, Jésus Christ. Bolingo lokola maladie contagieuse, tout n'a pas mouré déçu, tout n'a pas veuve d'amour, surtout tout n'a pas divorcé. Bako pesa yo témoignage na bango, okoyo kamawa.
We have been listening to Jebe Piana with the song For de l'amour. I'm John Tanza in Washington. I must admit, I feel like dancing now, but I can't dance in this studio. Thanks for allowing us into your cars and homes. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.